Hey, you know something? I really hope that this is somewhere in the order of the 14th program of this that you've listened to in a row, that you're podcasting. You've listened to it live to air, of course, but you've then gone back and podcasted them just back to back. Because if you have, then you will be in the right frame of mind to have the conversation that we are about to have today as we try to traverse the ethical and moral terrain of modern life. Welcome to the Waleed Ali Show. My bald sidekick is Scott Stevens, and he joins me now. How are you, Scott?
Well, Waleed, would you believe, though, I get tweets all the time from people who are on long-haul flights and have listened to the entire Minefield series in a single hit. Can you believe it?
That's actually, what episode are we up to now? But maybe 30 or something?
Something like that. Oh, no, couldn't
so
be that
many. So
that's
15 hours. That'll get you to LA.
I love the idea of the Waleed Show and his bald sidekick. I think that's great.
Can I just point out to people listening, you had been gagging about that. This isn't something that I decided just to bring to the table.
No, I think it's terrific.
And change the name of it, just so we're clear.
I'm happy to be known as your wingman, mate.
Fair enough.
On today's program, let's get down to brass tacks. Who would have thought that watching television as much as we do and watching television the way we do it could be so dangerous?
There's an epidemic sweeping our country that we need to talk about.
It's not good for you. It's not good for America.
On the danger scale, it's somewhere between gang violence and a curable STD. Probably closer to a curable STD.
Hi, I'm Cameron Manheim. This epidemic we speak of is binge watching.
Binge watching.
Binge watching.
And it's everywhere you look.
Netflix, Hulu, Amazon.
In the basement of your creepy friend Steve, who has every episode of Airwolf and Small Wonder on VHS.
But having too many episodes at your disposal can be overwhelming and hazardous to your health.
You know, I can't see their tongues, Scott. I imagine they are somewhere in the vicinity of their cheeks. But the phenomenon of binge-watching, I think, is a wonderful thing for us to explore because I'm going to run the prosecution against it. I think not only is this problematic when it comes to the creative process, but I think this represents a more corrosive social ethic more broadly. Hmm. I'm going to go there today. But before we get there, we should probably confine our initial observations to what it does for TV and the experience of watching it. Do you do it often?
Oh, yes and no. It really depends on the program. I find that older programs lend themselves particularly well to binge watching. So, for instance, can I just say, you know, I've gone through all 7 seasons of The West Wing, for instance, in a ridiculously short period of time with my wife. I mean, that's one of the first...
Because you're catching up socially. That's what's happening there, aren't you?
I think so. But I think the other thing, and as soon as you begin reflecting about the modern phenomenon of binge watching, you realize that one of the things that older television shows did is they didn't have the great vast narrative arcs. There wasn't this single, if you like, the single story, this single idea or series of characters that are being integrally developed over the course of week to week so that the end of one show bleeds so easily into the next. The older television programs, and not just sitcoms, but also fairly straightforward dramas, they might have the odd overarching conspiracy, as you might find in X-Files, but for the most part, every episode was more or less self-contained. There was an easy introduction, there was the easy denouement, and then you could easily slip into the next episode. With more modern television, you notice that it's that narrative arc. If you think about shows like The Wire, The Sopranos, more recently The Walking Dead to some extent, if you think about House of Cards, True Detective, I'm not even going to mention Game of Thrones. I refuse to watch it. I'm going to leave that to you. But each of these shows have this deep and you know, this kind of this very important narrative theme that run through each episode. So what you're actually doing is watching a really, 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 really long movie with some of the best writing, with some of the best character development, with some of the best acting we've ever seen. I think it's that narrative continuity that makes binge watching more tempting, but at the same time, it's that narrative continuity that makes binge watching more dangerous. In other words, you're going to mount the social argument against it. I'd like to mount the aesthetic argument against it. But over to you first.
You know what? In that case, I'm going to abandon mounting the aesthetic argument against it because actually when it comes down to it, I quite like it. So that will be awkward
so
for me
you
to
do.
And
you do binge watch?
I do binge watch. House of Cards was probably where it started for me. I'm trying to catch up on Breaking Bad. So, you know, I do have those sorts of things. I actually think there are elements of it that have been really great for the creative process. But I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to leave that to our guest to talk through because she actually writes stuff and knows how this works, whereas I just form a passive and uninformed view, which generally is fine in media, but I think today, since we've got an expert, we may as well defer to her. But I want to explore what it's like for the audience because perhaps the most obvious observation to make is that as we have embarked upon binge watching, what we have ceased doing, by necessary implication, is watching together as a society, as a nation. So that old hackneyed cliche of the water cooler conversation, the water cooler show, has disappeared. But as hackneyed as that expression is, I feel like it captured something of real social value. The idea of a shared experience of a kind of ritual where it was in some ways a slightly inadequate replacement for the theatre, where we would come together to witness something and then we would go on a process of discovery about what we'd just witnessed in our conversations that would take place in the immediate aftermath and then for a whole week proceeding. And so the show that we had just watched was in the process of still realising itself, realising all of its possibilities and exploring all the thematic limits of itself through our own social interactions. I worry about what happens when you take that away. And I worry about that from the perspective, I suppose, of the shows themselves, but just from the perspective of social growth, I suppose, if that's not too lofty a way of conceiving of it?
Well, no, I don't think it's too lofty a way because ultimately, if you think about it, television is a relational good. If we want to talk about it in strict kind of sociological and political terms, television is a relational good. It's something, it's a means by which people can in fact come together to discover things about each other by focusing on some point in common. I think that's where the collective or the social dimension of television is extremely interesting. I think we first saw it, believe it or not, Waleed, not so much in the first televised dramas, but in the way in which news, especially if you think about the great iconic news programs of Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite, the way that on a fixed time each night, everybody came together. Now, this is something overtly nostalgic. I mean, we shouldn't hide behind this. But there is something almost ritualistic about it. People came together for a shared common experience. They were watching alone, but at the same time, they were watching together because it invariably informed and it created, it shaped the overall social conversation. I think one of the interesting things, if you sort of carry that over into drama, those shows that have such a powerful narrative that they draw people in, and in the intermissions, in the breaks, they get us questioning, they get us reflecting about the characters, about their virtues, about their qualities, and I think ultimately at a very deep moral level, whether they reflect something that we like or don't like about ourselves.
Can I broaden this out to something that goes well beyond entertainment? The fear I have for that kind of breakdown in the collective ritualistic aspects, the social aspects of watching TV, is that I fear that it actually reflects a breakdown in those ritualistic and social aspects of pretty much everything. That is to say, binge watching to me doesn't create, but is representative of an ethos that we have now taken so deeply to heart in our culture of instant gratification at the instant moment that we require it, on demand, conveniently wrapping itself around our individual schedules. And I think this shows up in all sorts of things. So there's the way we watch TV, there's the way we will stream news, there's the way that we will gather news via social media. But it's even in little things, and the best example I can think of that illustrates it, that is trivial, is it even comes down to the way that we order coffee. And I know we've spoken about this, and I don't actually order coffee, but those who do, you can't just order a coffee anymore. What you have to order is the most specifically tailored beverage. It's got to be extra hot with a little bit of extra milk and this much cinnamon added on top of it, and it's got to be this macchiato, whatever. And like, you can write a novel just with a menu of available coffee beverages now. And what happens with that is a kind of valorizing of the ego, I would argue. This idea that your desires are so important that they must be catered for at every single turn. The idea that coffee is coffee and you either reconcile yourself with it or you don't, you either decide that it's good enough and you're happy to imbibe it or you don't, but that there is kind of a world that you might actually need to reconcile yourself with to some extent. It's a negotiated process. I feel like that ethic, that whole ethic has completely gone by the wayside and culture's just become just a fulfillment of desire.
And
really.
In fact, where the individual has actually become the basic social unit, the default political unit. It is interesting, Waleed. I can't even believe I'm doing this. Let me let my inner philosophical Marxist come out. I mean, one of the great early influences on me were some of the great kind of European Marxist schools that saw prevailing political conditions being reflected in social products, whether it be opera, whether it be music, whether it be novels or whatever. I mean, this is actually really quite telling. That in our overall political climate, it is in fact the individual voter, the individual as acquisitive, the individual as desiring political subject to whom our politicians have to make their sales pitch. In other words, each election is no longer about this is a good that we can realize in common. This is an aspiration to which we together will proceed. Instead, it is I will maximize your opportunity. I will ensure that no obstacle stays in your way between you and the realization of your specific tailor-made acquisitive desire. I think wherever we can find it, we need to recover these social or relational goods that we have to wait for and that don't necessarily have to wait for us and or give themselves or lend themselves to us. And so, I mean, to my mind, one of the great arenas for political activism is bringing back the weekly television show that's no longer available in between.
Yeah, but it's disappearing.
That's right.
If everything becomes tailored to our individual tastes, our individual schedules, then the whole idea of the social, which is all about shared schedules and shared tastes, it seems must
and
be
patience, ventured. Of course, and patience.
Yes, yes, the virtue of waiting a whole week to watch an episode of MASH. God, I can't believe we managed to make that a virtue. Has this show completely disappeared up its... Anyway, you're listening to The Minefield. You can leave a comment on our website if you like. Search for RN The Minefield or tweet us at RN The Minefield. Hey, remember this moment?
We can finally sort out the baby's room.
And then there you'll be, there, unless...
Unless what? Patrick? Patrick. Say something, count to ten. Count to ten? Open your eyes. Okay, Patrick, just say something. Oh, shit, Patrick.
It's a huge moment. In fact, an iconic moment for fans of the Australian drama Offspring when the much-loved character Patrick died. It's right up there with JR being shot, isn't it? And with us today is the co-creator and head writer of five seasons of Offspring, Deborah Oswald. Hello, Deborah.
Hi. Good morning.
Now, I can't quite imagine that binge-watching was much of a thing when you first set out to write Offspring.
No, it's interesting hearing you guys talk and feeling responsible for the moral education of the entire society. I'm just going to try to hold that at bay. I think Lots of Ways Offspring may one of the last programs of the old way of doing things that where people really did have to wait for the next Wednesday night. And since then, obviously, people get box sets or they download and binge watch it. But at the time, people were waiting episode by episode. Those days are gone.
So take us into the creative process. We sort of touched on before what this might mean for the quality of what's being written, but also the process of writing. Would you prefer to... What would create better art for you? To write for an audience that it takes it in week by week or to write for a binge-watching audience?
Well, at the risk of sort of, you know, yearning for a time that's gone, I do love the week-by-week thing. I think... there's something great, as you guys were saying, about audiences having to sit with the choices and the moral dilemmas that a character's facing at the end of an episode and let that ferment in their mind for a week and talk about it and think about it. I think it's particularly so for drama that is trying to draw on the rhythms of everyday life in the way that Offspring was, and Friday Night Lights is an American series that I really love. Mm. And there the time gap could make stories feel... that time was passing and that events were weighing on the characters. And maybe that's not an issue in a sort of breathlessly plotty show like a zombie show. But I think for drama that's trying to be about, you know, the meat of real life, the waiting for a week, the sort of weight of time was valuable.
Absolutely. Look, Deborah, you've just gotten very, very Aristotelian there, by the way, because, I mean, what you've just described, though, is the way that...
Don't worry, Deborah, Scott thinks everyone's Aristotelian.
I do think everyone's Aristotelian.
I think I might be. I'll wear that proudly.
Why can't you be?
It's an objective category to which we should all aspire. I mean, one of the things that Aristotle did imagine when he thought about the theatre was actually the characters themselves, the actors conveying their art in such a way that their moral dilemmas become internalized by the audience themselves, and that sort of sitting with the characters becomes a way for the audience to undergo a kind of morally formative process. But let me mention why I brought up Aristotle. I'm not a plot-driven guy. I mean, for me, the most interesting shows are the shows where the plot or the style of the show is fairly stereotypical. If you think about a zombie show or you think about a police procedural, what's more interesting to me is when these stereotypical shows then become a platform for very deep, very complex and internally conflicted character development, where week by week we sit with these characters, we plumb the depths, if you like, of their own relationship between good and evil. It seems to me we cannot appreciate the depth of that characterological dimension if you're simply watching one episode after another after another.
No, I think that's true. But can I just say that I think that the absolutely most eloquent storytelling moments are about plot, when it's resting on a bed of very deep characterization, a little tiny plot moment, like, I don't know, in The Crucible or something, can be more eloquent than any kind of bit of sort of character-based blah-blah scene.
Okay.
So, you know, I don't think the two are actually in conflict. I think when the characterization is strong, plot is the most extraordinarily eloquent way to say something.
So it sounds to me, though, Deborah, if I may turn on a dime and now argue for binge-watching and what it does for
the
art of writing. Yeah, absolutely, and I enjoy doing it, so I'm not being holier-than-thou about it, but I wonder if there is actually an artistic good that might come from it, because surely if you take a moment like that where it's the small gesture that carries an epic meaning, surely the binge-watching style of writing, where you are writing, as Scott says, effectively one story over many, many weeks, that surely that lends itself even more to laying the foundations for a moment like that to carry something enormous. That is, it's hard to do that in one episode of a drama. It's surely easier to do that when you've been building that drama or that murder mystery or whatever it is over the course of 10 hours.
Well, I think we're going to have to learn to do it, even if we aren't doing it yet, because that's the reality.
Do you think not?
We used to arc out each series of Offspring, the 13 episodes, and set a quest for our character at the beginning and play that out over the whole 13. So we used to do that at the beginning of the process. We weren't writing, unlike a procedural show, we weren't writing week to week. But then we would want every episode to feel like a satisfying whole, you know, that people sort of got their money's worth from their, got their time's worth, got their hour's worth out of that each episode. In a way, the principles are the same, I mean, from a dramatist's point of view, which is don't be boring, try to make it deeper, try to surprise people without being phony. I mean, a lot of those principles are the same whatever you're doing. I think the risk with a lot of the short things is, it's more about length than it is about binging, actually. There's this great love of the puzzle in drama now, this great love of the withholding of the revealing of secrets and the withholding of information and the sort of, you know, often quite ridiculous, perverse twist that's not based on character at all. And I think that's quite a sort of low-grade form of storytelling. I think it can be fantastic, but it's not classic storytelling, which is about a human being in a dilemma, making a choice, and consequences flow from that choice.
Okay, but Scott, we've had this conversation off air. Are we not in a golden age of television?
Look,
so many people are saying this, that the writing has never been better, the storytelling's never been better, the stories have never been better. How does that square with the observations we're making now?
Yeah, look, I'm stunned by the narrative and characterological depth, if you like, of modern television. But let me just pick up one point, though, that I think Deborah was raising. I mean, the rhythms of the human life, which I think the best dramas actually capture accurately, the rhythms of human life aren't, you know, massive, regular, cataclysms that we then have to wait for weeks and weeks and weeks to resolve. Instead, it's the momentary choices. It's the momentary aspects where sort of deep pathos comes to bear and character is revealed. It just strikes me that when you've got these shows that are designed for binging, all of the weight is at the end of the season. You know what I mean? Everything is arced towards this huge finale, this huge climax, so that you then get people tuning in to the following season. What weekly drama does, I think so beautifully, is it captures the more immediate, the low-grade, but nonetheless deeply heart-rending rhythms and crises of everyday life. I mean, surely that's something worth holding on to.
But surely we're forgetting that a lot of these shows that we're writing off as being binge-watched are actually being aired week to week. I mean, Game of Thrones is an example of that. An example like House of Cards, where it's all released at the same time and it's basically inviting you, go watch it now at once. That's actually the rarest of exceptions. Are we overstating what the phenomenon of binge-watching as an activity is doing to the creative process as it gets rolled out for audiences?
Well, it's interesting because in Australia, I think we're still catching up, aren't we?
So, yeah, so well, less and less, but yes.
We probably binge-watch more than people do in the US. I mean, yeah. For me, Justified was one of my favourite shows. As each episode would land in the Apple inbox, ABC, sorry, in the inbox, I could not control myself. I would have to watch it the night it arrived in the inbox. So there's different kinds of poor self-control, aren't there? There's the poor self-control that means you watch all 13 hours of something, and then there's the self-control that means that you bash your partner awake and say, we're watching Justified now.
Yeah, but I mean, are we simply at the point where the best that we can hope for, I mean, okay, people are not going to stop binge-watching, and to be perfectly honest, probably neither should they. But I think there ought to be a kind of awareness that with that lack of self-control, with that kind of, you know, consumption in a single gulp, if you like, that we are actually missing dimensions that we eventually will feel the loss of. I mean, even if there is that kind of nostalgic awareness, geez, I really liked it when, for instance, I was chatting with people about what happens next on True Detective between episodes. I mean, at least that kind of awareness might be something that bodes well for the future.
I think it's kind of become a little bit more like novel reading, that you'll read a novel that you love, and then you'll talk to your friends and say, read this novel, it's great.
Yeah, okay.
Especially read it soon so I can talk to you about it. That's how television works among my friends, that we'll watch something and love it, and then you'll be desperate for someone else to watch it so you can talk about it.
Which goes straight to the relational dimension of it. Nice. Okay.
The idea that this is like a novel, I suppose it's also like music, where an album, although it does get, a song might get pumped out on radio a lot, an album kind of gets gradually discovered amongst people and takes a position like that. But it does mean you lose that feeling of everybody watching at the same time. And I wonder if the only thing left that really does that now, I suppose, is reality TV, but also then for the same reason, sport. Because you have no choice. You can't really binge-watch sport. It's not even fun to do that. So you actually have to go through the week-to-week journey, and maybe that's part of its heightened appeal, Scott, at the moment.
I was just waiting for you to bring that in. Yeah, look, I think so. I mean, sport is that kind of televised ritual, though, that does bring people together in a kind of peaceful conflict. I would suspect that precisely because, okay, I mean, good television characters can be divisive. Plots can be divisive. The style of a show can be divisive. But there is something fundamental about television, about televised drama, that is intent on bringing people together around a common conversation. I'm just not sure. Unless you're talking about sporting highlights, I'm not sure you get the same thing either in sport or in reality television.
So, Deborah,
can I say one more final thing about binge-watching that are positive, since we've been so negative about it? One of the disadvantages of the old self-contained episode was that it got very predictable. You know, if it's 9:05, that guy can't be the killer, right?
Yes,
or if it's
yes.
9:05, that's not the disease. House is going to find out what it is in 10 more minutes. You know, there was something predictable about the story shapes.
Except for the to be continued, Deborah. Don't forget the to be continued.
Of course. But now that we've unpacked that, particularly sort of standard thriller shapes or rom-com shapes, I mean, one of the great things about Offspring was that the people run together in a major transport hub and kiss, which would be the end of a rom-com film. But in a long-running series, what's next? And that's interesting stuff, I think.
Deborah Oswald, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Great. Thanks, guys.
See, she survived the minefield again, Scott. Deborah Oswald, co-creator, head writer for the first five seasons of Offspring, one of the most loved dramas in Australian television history,
yes.
I would say, Scott.
You can actually join us this coming Monday on the RN Facebook page for a special live Q&A. I'll be there. I'll be sort of laying my principles aside and wandering onto Facebook just to sort of engage with you in a little bit of chat. You can just go to the RN The Minefield page and find out some details.
I sadly will not be there, but I might adopt a pseudonym and start throwing insulting questions Scott's way, just
can't
for
wait.
Fun. If you heard anything that you want to jump in on and have a conversation with us about, please do tweet us at RN The Minefield. Until next week, this has been The Minefield. We'll see you soon.